Today's March 31st, 2015. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. And Mr. Siebert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just remind you that you stopped on slide number 50 of the presentation today. Or yesterday, and they'll be picking up on the key performance measures. If you're looking for those in the appendix, they are on page 54 of 234 of the online appendix file. And then I would also note there's some materials at your place that the department provided that they referenced during yesterday's hearing.
All right, and we'll go ahead and call up Director Melcher.
Good morning, Co-Chair Ray Feld, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, here for day two. And we're going to start this morning with finishing up my agency overview, including our key performance measures, and then we'll move into Mr. Ron Anglin's presentation on the wildlife programs. And if we have time, we'll move then subsequently into the Fish Division overview. So with regard to the agency's key performance measures, we do have eight legislatively approved key performance measures. By way of overview, three of those eight are in the red zone. Five of the eight are in the green zone as it relates to achievement of the key performance measures. I'll go through each of them individually here, talk a little bit about the key performance measure and our either achievement or lack of achievement of each measure. So our first key performance measure is hunting license purchases. This is essentially a per capita target of 10% of Oregon residents between the age of 12 and 69 that are purchasing licenses. Our key performance measure for that proportion of purchasing is 10%. As you'll see, our current status is at 8.3% of the population, the eligible population between ages 12 and 69 are purchasing hunting licenses. And I'll talk a little bit about the angling license key performance measure as well, and then talk a little bit about some of the factors that are contributing to our lack of achievement of both of these measures. So angling license purchases, again, this is a per capita target. With a percent of the eligible population, that would be individuals between the ages of 14 and 69, eligible to participate in fishing and required to purchase a fishing license. Our target, our key performance measure target is 21.4% of the statewide population, eligible population. As you'll see in the slide, we are currently at 17.4%. These trends, so overall, both of these per capita purchasing trends over the last really three decades have been declining. It's a factor that we've long recognized. It's not unique to Oregon. This is a phenomena that's observed really across the country as it relates to fishing and hunting participation, but particularly in the West. There's a number of factors that contribute to that. And as you saw yesterday in our slides, on a raw level, on a gross scale, our sales over the last decade have been basically flat, flat for 10 years. However, the population of Oregon continues to increase. Thus, our proportion of individuals purchasing licenses continues to decrease. There's a number of factors that contribute to this. One, there's societal factors related to more urbanization and folks living in urban areas and focusing thus on other activities, activities other than fishing and hunting. As we talked about yesterday, individuals certainly are, and it appears, shifting into other outdoor activities, including wildlife watching as a component of those activities. And as I talked about yesterday, we've taken great measures as it relates to recruiting, retaining, and reactivating our licensed buyers. We recognize that we're not going to turn this trend around overnight, but hopefully over the long term, as we continue to focus on recruiting particularly younger anglers and younger hunters, as well as the rest of the population, we'll be able to turn the trend around. Mr. Co-Chair, do you want to take questions on each of these as I go, or do you want me to go through all of them? What's your pleasure on this?
We'll just kind of feel the panel out as
okay.
we go.
Okay, fine.
I actually did have a couple of questions on KPM 1 and 2. It looks like there's over 14, 15, like a steady decline of hunting licenses. And angling licenses is not so dramatic, but there is, a steady decline with not much change as well. And so I was kind of, curious as we kind of talked yesterday about, I had some people in my office as well yesterday where we talked about their parents hunted. They hunted as when they were younger, they stopped hunting, and their children will never hunt. So kind of the same thing with fishing and things like that. And looking at that decline that once they're out of it, they don't come back. And so, looking at this decline and talking about the retention, some of those other things, and then also the combination with the fee increases, those were some of the things that I wanted to just, the overall strategy, just kind of curious a little bit more about that.
So. Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair. And so certainly there's a cross-generational component to these activities. Folks, as you mentioned, folks who grow up fishing or grow up hunting are certainly much more likely to continue that tradition and carry that tradition on to the youths in their family. As we've looked at, again, the population continuing to grow, focusing in urban areas, large-scale demographic shifts, certainly folks' interest in these activities has waned as a on a per capita level. In terms of absolute sales, pretty flat over the last decade. We have a very small marketing and advertising budget that's directed at recruitment and retention. As we're really looking at it a little bit more organically. So we've got a number of efforts underway. As society changes, so does interest in, for instance, technology. So you've seen, as we showed you yesterday, we have a number of technological pieces that are aimed to hopefully attract and pique the interest of younger participants, web-based and mobile phone application-based regulations being one example. But also, when one of the key actions that we're taking right now, for instance, on the fish side, we're undergoing a rigorous process to reduce the complexity of our regulations. So one of the barriers for new participants is regulations are very complex. The complexity of regulations are really a reflection of 3 decades of continuous management, high level of interaction by the public in their interest in regulations, which has led to this complexity, and we're now trying to bring that back essentially to simplify regulations, lower the barriers for individuals to participate, and hopefully turn this tide of declining per capita participation. It's not an easy nut to crack. It's not unique to Oregon, but there's work nationally going on as well.
I guess my follow-up question would be, as recreational users, is the prices of, say, the for the fishing licenses will eventually go up to, I think it was $44, by 2020. Recreational folks who might go out 3 or 4 times a year, have you guys looked at what that will do to kind of the folks that are only going out about 3 or 4 times a year? So myself with my son, if there was something that was $44, I'm probably less likely to go purchase that. If I'm only going to go out a couple times a year, I might choose a different activity. Have you guys looked at the impacts that that will have on some of these numbers?
Certainly for many of our marginal customers, there is an impact associated with any fee, whether it's a low fee, a high fee, moderate fee. There's a impact of pricing. One of the things that we've done in this package is we're approaching it with incremental increases, and that's one of the things we heard from folks in our surveying, that incremental increases were more preferred as opposed to the one-step large increase that we've utilized in the past. additionally, when we've done some customer surveying and we ask them about the factors that lead to their participation or lack of participation, and the cost of participation is very low on the list. There's many, many other factors that go into whether they participate in these activities. Cost is relatively low on the list of factors. Fishing and hunting are not inexpensive activities, or at least they, for many folks, there's a full spectrum of folks that spend very little on those activities to folks who spend very large amounts of money on those activities. So we're certainly sensitive to that. We recognize, as I said yesterday, that this is a discretionary activity, and we're competing in the marketplace for really discretionary dollars that folks spend on whatever activity it may be. So I guess I just relay a little an interesting story. I have a friend, if I may, that he's very well off, and he told me he had taken his wife and son fishing in Sun River on the Deschutes, and he started to complain about the cost, and I thought to myself, how can he be complaining about the daily license at $17? You can afford a $17 license. And I said that to him. He said, oh, no, it's not the license. I'm complaining about the guide I had to hire that was costing me $400. So anyway, I think for many folks, there's a full spectrum. Our customer base includes everyone from folks with limited resources to folks with abundant resources. And hopefully we don't price folks out. Attempting to keep families interested in at a low cost, lowering the cost for youth as well as non-resident youth. These are all to address our interest in recruiting and retaining anglers.
Thank you, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Director. We've been talking a little bit about the declining numbers of hunting and angling licenses, but can you segment out for us the short-term licenses, the one-day, the three-day licenses, and how those trends may compare to the overall trend?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gomberg, we certainly have those statistics. I believe our daily sales have been increasing, but we'll provide those in follow-up. I don't have them on the top of my head here, but we have detailed statistics on all of our license category sales over time.
I'd appreciate if we could get some feedback on that. A follow-up, Mr.
Absolutely.
Chairman. I appreciated your anecdote sincerely, and I wanted to share one of my own. My district hosts the largest charter fleet in Oregon, and the owners of those small businesses down there are concerned about the cumulative effect of short-term license increases. What they're saying to me is that they put together trips that will include a day fishing trip and a crabbing trip, and currently those licenses would cost about $27, but with the proposed increases, by year 2020, those combined licenses plus the additional $1 surcharge would take that to about $45, roughly a 40% increase. A lot of the people using those services are seeing them as discretionary. Yes, there's the expense of coming to the beach, staying in a hotel, having dinner, but do we add a fishing trip on top of that? They don't have the expense of equipment. They just simply have the expense of the trip and the fees, and the fees are approaching about 50% of the cost of the overall trip. So they're concerned that they're going to be losing traffic when, at least initially, what you're suggesting is this is one area where we're seeing increases rather than decreases. I'd hate to thwart that trend.
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gomberg, as we get into Senate Bill 247, we're going to go through all the individual fee proposals in detail. I don't believe that the daily cost of participation increases that dramatically. So we'll tease that out and have the real numbers before you.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so moving on then, wildlife damage, KPM number 3, which is the number of wildlife damage complaints addressed annually. Our key performance measure target is that this number should be less than 4,000. As you'll see from this slide, we are achieving, actually less than 4,200. We are achieving that target over time as we continue to educate folks on proactive measures that they can do to reduce conflict, to reduce wildlife damage. We think we're making headway in this particular category. Species of concern monitored. This is the KPM number 4. It's also the third KPM that we have where we are not in the green category. Percent of fish species of concern that are being monitored. So these would be species that are listed either as endangered, threatened, or sensitive under the state or federal endangered species acts. We have approximately 50 species that or populations that meet that criteria. We're currently monitoring, I believe it's 30, I don't have to look at my notes, but it's 37, I believe, of those 50 populations. We have declined in this category. We were at 85% last biennium. We're at 71% this biennium, and that is largely the result of a federally funded study that was underway where we were monitoring 6 different populations of red band trout in eastern Oregon. Those federal funds, it was a 6-year project, those federal funds have ended, and thus that monitoring has gone away.
Director, you're going to lose those 48 positions we talked about yesterday. How will that affect your ability to do some of these things?
Co-Chair Rayfield, as it relates to our monitoring efforts, we actually prioritized monitoring in our budget development. And so you'll see that the positions that are slated for elimination are not related to monitoring.
So in 2 years when you come back, we won't see a decline?
Co-Chair Rayfield, I don't believe so, and hopefully we will see an increase. Part of the purpose of the 6-year federally funded study was to look at alternative ways to monitor these populations that are they cost effective. You know, they occur over broad landscapes, and so we're really looking to focus and improve our monitoring in a cost effective way for these populations. KPM 5, Oregon Species of Concern. This is the similar KPM on the wildlife side, which is the percent of wildlife species of concern that are being monitored. We have a KPM target of 48% of these species should be monitored, and we are achieving that target at 52%. A lot of that is through collaboration with other agencies, non-governmental organizations, as well as academic institutions. KPM 6, number of unscreened water diversions. We have across the state, you know, thousands of water diversions for irrigation and other municipal purposes, other purposes. Many of these diversions are not screened. We've had a long-term KPM to continue to reduce the number of unscreened diversions. We continue to make progress in that category. I believe we helped or assisted installing screens on 67 diversions in the last biennium, so we continue to make progress. Customer service, we have even years, we do an extensive customer service survey of individuals, a randomized survey of individuals that have had that have come to our offices for support. These do not include individuals who purchase licenses at part of our private party vendor network, but individuals who come to our offices for a variety of activities, be they licensing, animal damage related issues. We have a KPM target of 92% of those individuals should have excellent or good customer service as it relates to timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, and availability of information. We are slightly below KPM, the total target of 92%, although it's still in the green category as it relates to the criteria that are used, with 85.9 to 91.4% of customers reporting across those categories that they had good or excellent service. And then lastly, KPM 8 relates to our Fish and Wildlife Commission and the percent of total best practices met by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. This is a survey that's conducted of our 7 volunteer citizen commissioners. You'll see that we have a KPM target of 100% compliance, and the result of those surveys, commissioners reporting that we were at 96% of best practices. Okay, moving on, I want to talk about our policy option packages. In the 2015-2017 governor's recommended budget, we have 27 policy option packages. The vast majority of these, 21, are continuations of packages that have been in previous biennia. As we receive federal funds for work, these we have to come back multiple sessions with policy option packages to continue that work. Six of them are what we would call our new KPM or KPMs, new policy option packages. Tying my tongue here a little bit with the acronyms. The six new policy option packages, none of them are other fund license funded packages. The six new packages then are listed here. POP 104 is a federally funded Klamath anadromous fish reintroduction plan development. So it's essentially one position to work on reintroduction of anadromous species above in the Upper Klamath Basin. POP 120 is a project that we've done with ODOT, a pilot project. Each time ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation, does maintenance on their culverts across the state, many times those activities trigger the fish passage statutes and require that passage be provided. Passage at many culvert at many culvert road crossings is very expensive. So we've worked out a pilot project with ODOT through our commission that allows them to do maintenance activities at these culverts, and in exchange they are funding fish passage work at higher priority projects. So we have a number of high priority fish passage projects that are going to be addressed through the ODOT funding, and so thus we have a policy package related to implementing that program. Willamette Falls fish ladder repair. We have a fish ladder at Willamette Falls. Of course, all the anadromous fish in the Willamette Basin, all of them above Willamette Falls, all the native populations are listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. We have a 50-year-old fish ladder there that, as you might imagine, is placed in a very dynamic environment right at the falls, and it is suffering from long-term deterioration. We have a federally funded POP to conduct $1 million worth of repairs at that facility. POP 128, which is also part of our capital construction bill, is a property acquisition on the Lower Deschutes River. This is an acquisition funded with federal funds. It will become part of our Lower Deschutes Wildlife Management Area and provide important access, fishing, hunting, and recreational access on the west side of the canyon on the Lower Deschutes. We have two sage-grouse-related POPs.
Yeah, Representative Klein.
What federal dollars is that? Like, what source of, what's the program?
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Klein, that is funded through the wildlife restoration budget, the also known as Pittman-Robertson excise tax on arms and ammunition, combined with some mitigation funds that we received for when the Ruby Pipeline was put in South and Southeast Oregon. We had a mitigation fund that resulted from that pipeline construction. So it's a combination of mitigation funds and federal funds from the Wildlife Sport Fish Restoration Program.
Do you remember the amount by any chance?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Clam, I believe the total cost of that property is in the $2.5 million range. And I believe about $1.5 million is federal. I can get you the specific details. We've been just by way of background, that project has been unanimously supported by the Wasco County Commission. We've been working with both Representative Smith and Representative Huffman on that project, and supported broadly by the hunting and the conservation community as well. And so we do have two POPs related to sage-grouse. These are general funded POPs. One is a sage-grouse mitigation coordinator. Right now, our commission is in the process of developing a mitigation policy specific to sage-grouse and mitigation in important core habitat for the sage-grouse population. As such, we have, and the governor proposed, a sage-grouse mitigation coordinator position. And POP 132, another general fund funded POP related to sage grouse, is to address pre- and post-fire resilience in sage grouse habitat. I've talked a little bit about these already, but we do have three legislative concepts. Senate Bill 247 is our agency fee bill. It encapsulates or includes all of our fee proposals, recreational, commercial, and occupational fees. And that bill is also here. Came through Senator Edwards' committee earlier this session. House Bill 2402 creates a legislative task force to look at long-term funding solutions and funding alternatives for how we pay for fish and wildlife-related conservation and stewardship in Oregon. As we talked about earlier, the model has previously been that those activities are largely paid with hunting and fishing license dollars. This is to look at it at a higher level and look to develop alternative funding models. And lastly, House Bill 2452, which I mentioned previously yesterday, is the bill related to our deferred maintenance account that would simply transfer the funds, the license dollars, from our deferred maintenance account to our operating account for cash flow purposes. With that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude. I think, and you're going to see here in the coming several presentations about the broad diversity of activities that the department is involved in, the work that we're doing that benefits all Oregonians, not just folks who fish and hunt. I think we have hopefully identified to you that we have identified our key budget drivers as we move forward, that we're taking these budget drivers seriously. We're taking actions to address them. We're implementing, as we talked about yesterday, recruitment, retention, and reactivation efforts. We're aggressively pursuing efficiency in our programs, and you're going to hear a little bit more about that from Mr. Bill Herber when he talks to you about our administrative programs. And lastly, that we are seeking alternative ways to fund our conservation and stewardship efforts. And with that, unless there are further questions, I'll hand it over to Mr. Anglin.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Director. Can we go back to slide 50 on KPM 8? I just have a couple of quick questions on that since it deals with the board. There's been some concern about the transparency of the department in relationship to the commission. And especially on, and I mentioned this the other day, wanting to get the figures on the litigation, but the spill that not once but twice the board was completely left in the dark. It really bothers me when the chair in a public meeting says, I didn't know anything about this proposal before the Northwest Power Plant Council until I read about it in the paper. And that, to me, is just inexcusable. And then having had that on the record, then within the month we take another course of action to sue, and the board again, as far as I know, was left out. So I guess I'm really concerned. There's the Senate Bill 125, which I've sponsored, to build in the transparency so that there's a requirement that the governor appointed Senate-approved board at least has the opportunity to weigh in on some of these major decisions. So when you say that that's one of your key performances to bring them in, I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that particular issue and then generally speaking how you would work as the new director.
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel. So we're certainly working with the commission. We're going to have two new commissioners here in the coming months. We're working with the commission to onboard them to make sure these questions were much, you know, there was much more to the questions than just the communication issue. I believe two commissioners out of the six that we currently have had a couple issues. One being, I think, the issue you're referring to, the lack of communication as related to some of these issues. We're working on that. We're committed to doing that. I think as it relates to the Columbia River biop litigation, you know, it's important to remember that the department is not the plaintiff in that case. The state of Oregon is. So we certainly help inform the governor's office as the state moves forward on that. But we were not the individual party that was filing that particular litigation. But we're committed to bringing the commission into the fold to make sure that they're well informed, that they're that their understanding of these big picture issues that are underway, and look forward to working with them in that capacity.
Paul, but I thought you said yesterday that that litigation comes out of your budget, so I think you are a party to it in some way.
Co-chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, we. And we are providing that, or we're preparing that, the summary of the cost of that litigation as it relates to the department's budget for you. We are not the plaintiff, but we are. We do pay a portion of the legal bills associated with it, at basically, at the request of the governor's office. So we do pay part of the legal bills, but we're not the department is not the plaintiff in the case.
Well, I understand that, but yeah. I think there's a nexus there between policy and your advice and that the board should have been involved, at least giving their ability to, from my opinion, their issues.
Director Melcher, we might get some clarity. Who made the decision to pursue the lawsuit?
Co-Chair Rayfield, that is made above, in the executive branch, but above the department level, I guess I would say.
And so it wasn't ODFW who was involved in that decision to pursue the lawsuit.
We were certainly involved in discussions, but we were not the decision maker. We're not the plaintiff in the case. The state of Oregon is. So as an executive branch agency, all the executive branch agencies essentially follow in line with that direction.
And that might help Senator Hansel's question.
I understood that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Any other? Yes, Representative Gomberg.
Well, as we're concluding this first part of the presentation, I just felt it appropriate to say, Director, I know that you're new at this, so even though you're following in the footsteps of an excellent interim director, I appreciate you. I appreciate what it's taken to pull this presentation together, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the week. But congratulations on your selection.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it. All right.
Good morning, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. I'm Ron Anglin, the Wildlife Division Administrator for the department, and I'll take a brief moment here to run through all of our major wildlife programs and how it relates to the overall budget. Yesterday, Kurt mentioned that conservation is foremost in all that we do, and it certainly is woven throughout everything we do within the Wildlife Division. Whether it's our monitoring and our species management, or working on various habitat projects, providing technical assistance to folks, or working individually with species. The division is set up fairly simply. We don't have a lot of FTE within the division. We actually are decreasing about 10 from what we had in the current biennium. And we're broken into three major budget categories: wildlife management, habitat resources, and conservation. We're primarily funded through license dollars, so that'd be the other fund, license dollars, and the sale of hunting licenses and tags, with the rest of our funding coming from federal funds, primarily PR dollars that Kurt mentioned, and then some lottery fund, and then within the governor's recommended budget, an infusion of general fund to support some of our activities that are not related to hunting. We'll focus first on the wildlife management side of the agency. This is really where most of our FTE are located. This is where most of our work occurs from an agency standpoint. We have a lot of things that we do, and I won't touch on all of those, but I do want to highlight a few of them. So you kind of have a flavor for how we go about doing our business. With wildlife management, this is where all of our huntable species are. So all of our deer, elk, bighorn sheep, antelope, mountain goats, bear, cougar, upland birds, waterfowl, sage grouse, they're all within this program, and we survey 100% of those species in some manner, whether it's from the air, which is quite expensive, It's using remote operated cameras, whether it's hair snares, whether it's through fecal DNA analysis, or out on the ground in vehicle or from boats. We survey these species, and they drive our population monitoring efforts. They drive our population estimates and really drive what we feel that we can do in the way of offering opportunity for the users of the state. A lot of what helps us get at how we manage species is what we do in the background in the way of research. And I remember several years ago somebody saying that healthy private businesses put a lot of effort into research and development. And we certainly feel that that's important in the natural resource world, and we put a lot of effort into researching what's going on with various species and how that might have a practical management application. And I'd like to just briefly touch on some of the things that we're doing. We certainly are seeing on the west side declines with black-tailed deer, and that's a huge concern to us as an agency. It's a huge concern to our constituents. And we're really trying to get a better feel for what's going on from a habitat condition standpoint and also what that population's doing. I don't know if you've spent much time in Western Oregon. Counting black-tailed deer is difficult at best. And historically, we've done that with spotlights, and it's kind of like trying to count fleas at night with a spotlight. It's just kind of an impossible task in coming up with any kind of a reliable estimate. And it's something that the western states and blacktail are only found in the coastal regions of the western states, something that we've also are all struggled with. And recently there's been some work developed up in Alaska on utilizing fecal DNA to estimate populations. So we're now, through our research unit that's located out of Roseburg, we're trying this technique out here in Oregon. We've selected units that were going in and collaring black-tailed deer, and then we're going back in utilizing, setting up transects and utilizing dogs to help us locate fecal samples, and then we can do a population estimate based on the amount of DNA that's collected and how many different DNA samples that we get from that area. And that allows us then to estimate density of deers, deer per habitat type, and then overall density throughout the unit. So this has a lot of promise. It's something that, like I said, was developed actually up in Alaska. And we're hopeful that this will be a technique that we can employ and give us some more reliable estimates here for Western Oregon. There's also some work going on in Washington that's developing some habitat utilization models that we're hopeful once that's completed, that grad student work is being completed, that that'll be applicable down here in Oregon, and we can use that to inform our decision-making and working with the Forest Service and the BLM on black-tailed deer habitat conditions on federal lands, which is where we've seen the bulk of our declines occur since there's very little timber harvest occurring on those lands at this point in time. In eastern Oregon, we also have been doing a lot of work with mule deer. And I'll touch a little bit on a study that we've just recently completed, and then later on in the presentation really get into some details of how we're taking that and transforming that into a new way of doing business in eastern Oregon. And what we looked at was recreating some work that we'd done back in the late 60s and early 70s with sight collars and collaring deer on winter range and then seeing where they went to their summer ranges. We knew there was this intermixing going on in the winter ranges out of Fort Rock and Silver Lake in south central Oregon, and we knew those deer didn't stay there in the summertime. We wanted to know where they went. So we had this old study, but with new technology and GPS collars, we had the ability to really update that and have more accurate data. Over the course of 5 years, we put out a little over 500 collars, and we developed over 1 million data points on those 500 deer, which was the largest data set that's ever been recorded for deer in the United States. And really what that gave us in conjunction with our partners on the project was a very good understanding of where those deer move to in the summertime and how we can better manage the deer. One of our major partners was ODOT in this project, and you can see on the map there's some yellow and red lines which represent some of the major highways. These were significant areas of interaction between deer and vehicles, and that was something that ODOT has a huge concern over. Obviously, we have a concern both from a human safety standpoint but also from a deer population standpoint, and how do we address that? And I'll show a little bit later on in our habitat portion, I'll show what ODOT has started implementing as a result of this study and how that has helped them with their management. Elk are a primary driver from a hunting standpoint, a viewing standpoint, and also from a wildlife damage standpoint across the state. And we have spent a lot of years working primarily out of Northeast Oregon, our research unit out of LeGrand, and also in the Southwest Cascades with our research unit out of Roseburg, looking at elk habitat use, quality and nutrition. Is that driving elk populations up or down, or are there other things going on like predation that are impacting elk populations? And what we found by and large across the state is that nutrition and pregnancy rates, excuse me, are not a problem for elk population in Oregon, that we're having adequate breeding going on, and we've got a good number of calves that are hitting the ground. And in those areas where we're seeing any kind of decline of elk populations, it typically is driven more with elk calf survival, which is related to predation. And we've looked at what those predation rates are like, and we've looked at how that may be influencing those populations. And then more recently, and I'll talk in more detail a little bit later, we've had a new predator move on to the landscape. As Kurt touched on yesterday, we have wolves that have moved into Northeast Oregon out of Idaho, and we want to know and understand how is that influencing our elk population here in the state, how is that influencing cougar populations, as has been noticed in some of the other states where they've also been doing research. So those are things that we're starting in Northeast Oregon with our research unit to really update our knowledge base on these interactions. We also know that there's a lot of interest in Southeast Oregon in sage grouse, but there's a lot of interest in economic development. These are very economically challenged counties, and they've been looking at opportunities for energy development. They've been looking at some mining opportunities, and we know that we have some species of concern out in the desert, and one of those is the kit fox. And we've been undertaking a collaring effort in Southeast Oregon, trying to map out kit fox home range, develop population estimates, and use that to better inform the decision makers on development opportunities and what those impacts might be and ways that we can work together to avoid those impacts, provide some economic opportunity while protecting wildlife. And we also have continued our work on cougars. And one of our folks said, I can't believe you finally agreed to allow a cougar kitten on your presentation because they're so cute. And they're right. Normally we have an adult cougar on here, but we've been working on cats for over 25 years here in Oregon, just almost continuously. And we have a wealth of information that's being used to develop cougar models. We have a wealth of information that's being used to inform us on the impacts of cougar on deer and on elk. And it really is helping us move forward with better cougar management.
Senator Hansel. Just out of curiosity, where's that kitten's mother?
Well, she's
sleeping?
Out killing elk.
She's probably sleeping right at this point in time. Typically what we'll do if we've got a female that we're fairly confident based on the GPS collar that's on her, we're fairly confident that she has a den and she's got kittens or cubs, we'll go in and we can tranquilize her very quickly using dogs, put her up a tree, tranquilize her, and then move in and get a hold of the kittens, weigh them, check them out, how healthy they are, and then be able to monitor through time their survival. Some of our research in Northeast Oregon has shown that cougar are, impacting elk. cougars select for elk calves when they're going after elk. They typically don't select for adult elk because you think about it, there's a lot of risk for a cougar to take on an adult elk. And there's not as much risk for them physically to take on a calf elk. Likewise, or similarly, when we look at what we found with cougar impacts on deer, cougar taking deer, adult deer and fawns at the same proportion. And it's made it interesting in trying to really measure how cougar are impacting deer populations, because if you take cougar out of the mix and you see a response in the deer population, you're seeing an equal rise in adults and fawns at the same time. And that means you have to be able to measure that level of a population increase versus on elk, what we're seeing is an increase in calf survival, which makes it a lot easier to model because your adult survivals remain fairly constant. So it's really presented a challenge to us and kind of driven that we need to look at some different ways to monitor deer populations so we can try and pick up that kind of a change. And that relates back to our South Central Mule Deer Study and the work that we did there and the collaring effort that we did there, and then some of the things that we've been doing from a monitoring standpoint and how we're going to roll into the future in counting deer in eastern Oregon. We have a series of wildlife areas throughout the state. There's 22 of them at this point in time. We manage over 200,000 acres. Some of those are in conjunction with DSL, like out at Savi Island. Those are primarily funded through the use of federal aid or PR dollars and the resultant match from license dollars. They provide a suite of habitats for a great deal of different species. And they provide a lot of recreational opportunity for a lot of different people. A couple of our recent wildlife areas that we've either acquired or are in the process of acquiring, the Coquille Valley Wetland Complex down out of Coquille in Coos County. This is a seasonal wetland primarily flooded through high water out of the Coquille River. It is the major stopover point for migrating water and shorebirds and waterfowl between the San Francisco Bay wetland complexes and the Columbia River complex, and is the most significant stopover spot for those birds as they're moving up and down the coast. Likewise, Kurt mentioned one of our POPs for the Lower Deschutes that would provide 10,000 acres adjoining another 10,000 acres of BLM land in the Lower Deschutes that would open up for public access and significant opportunities for deer, elk, bighorn sheep, and upland bird hunting, and then viewing and other recreational opportunities. During our last budget cycle and fee request, one of the things that our director at the time heard, no matter where he went in Oregon, whether it was Gold Beach, Brookings, Coos Bay, or eastern Oregon, is where are all the mule deer? You know, they're going away, and you need to do something about it. And he made the decision that we would do something about it, and the start of that was our mule deer initiative. And with that last fee increase, and hopefully with the fee increase we'll get this time, we'll be able to contend and continue and expand that work. We selected 5 units in eastern Oregon where we wanted to do targeted things to improve conditions for mule deer. Our wildlife districts picked out these 5 units. It's a variety of habitats. We then formed local working groups to assist us in developing a suite of actions that we'd try and implement. And then we went forward with those actions. And we kind of spread them out. We didn't do them all in each of the units, except for the habitat restoration. That occurred in everything. It was amazing what happened as a result of that. You know, we provided the leadership, and we were shocked at the amount of people that came out of the woodwork and wanted to partner up with us and wanted to do work in these units. The NRCS was a significant player in stepping up and bringing money to the table to work on mule deer. We actually dovetailed it in the Steens and the Warner unit down in Lake County with some sage-grouse work. And we have made a significant inroad into turning things around in those units with these partners. Also includes Forest Service, BLM, and a lot of our private hunting organizations have stepped up with both dollars and volunteer time. And then private landowners have really come to the table with their own money, their own equipment, and really stepped in and helped do things. I talked earlier about doing business differently for counting mule deer, and I want to go back a little bit to the slide I showed earlier of the South Central Mule Deer Study, and it showed a whole bunch of lines and black dots, and we talked about where those deer go. Well, in this slide, the map actually shows the dots are where we collared deer on the winter range. And then the arrows show the different directions the deer from those winter range localities went to their various summer ranges. And you can start to see significant movement of animals off of those winter ranges, in some cases down into California, some cases into the Cascades, some cases back and forth between Bend and down south. And so this really highlighted for us that maybe we should not be managing deer on a unit-by-unit basis, but we should be managing deer from a herd range basis. So we manage it more as a collective. And we are now in South Central managing all of these units as more of a herd range, and because they are interrelated. And we recognized that we needed to do the same thing throughout the rest of Eastern Oregon. Our folks devised the method on doing this, and we just completed last week laying out or hanging out 500 collars on mule deer in the Blue Mountains in Central Oregon on up into Northeastern Oregon. And our intent is that once we get through with this project, and we'll also expand into the rest of Eastern Oregon, it will give us the ability to manage all mule deer in Eastern Oregon in a similar manner by herd range. And just thought we'd show you real quick some video footage of one of the does that we collared. You can see the GPS collar that we put on her. It gives us the locations. We always restrain the animals so that they're not kicking, won't hurt themselves, or the people that are trying to handle them. But when we do release them, you know, and we try and do this all very quickly, but when we do release them, you'll see, watch their hind feet when they run away. They will kick. And this one was successfully released and is already providing us with information on locations of animals.
Question. Ron, are you finding the species white blacktail mule deer, is there any difference in the ability to fend off predation among species, or the deer are pretty much all equally vulnerable?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, deer are all equally vulnerable. We've actually, some of our previous research on blacktails did not see much impact from predation other than bobcats on blacktail fawns. But with the collaring that we're doing now, we actually have been pretty surprised. We're starting to see cougar predation on adult deer that in the past we had not seen. So as our predator populations have increased, we certainly are seeing some more impacts. And as you see deer populations decline, those impacts can have a bigger difference in the overall herd health and the ability of a population to rebound or recover.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. Continuing the discussion of predation and cougars particularly, so how do you decide when a cougar population is too large, you know, that the impacts on deer? I mean, how do you work the hydraulics on this?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dimbrough, you know, in the past, all fish and wildlife agencies have pretty much managed on a single species by single species basis, and they haven't looked at how things interrelate. And when we rewrote our cougar plan in 2005, we specifically made the decision that we wanted to look at how cougar are interacting not only with livestock and from a damage concern with human safety, and then also how they're interacting with other game species or their prey species. We have not at this point in time set any kind of a population objective for cougars. We're just pretty much letting them go where they'll go. We've set what we would consider a floor that we don't want the population to drop below, and if it were, then we would shut down recreational hunting. But the cougar population has continued to grow. We estimate there's around 6,000 in the state, give or take 1,000 or so. We think that we are starting to see for the first time, you know, or document impacts from cougars on deer population and in some cases elk populations. And, you know, there's folks that'll say, well, the literature or the science doesn't support that. And I guess that you really have to look back in time where a lot of the research and the science was developed when cougar populations were at very, very low numbers. You know, they were almost eradicated. They were considered vermin. They were poisoned. They were indiscriminately trapped and hunted, and they were at extremely low numbers. And when we collectively were doing research on cougars during those times, there wasn't much of an impact because there weren't many of them. Since then, across the West, we've seen a rebound in cougar numbers. And, you know, we view it as an agency as a success that we took them from the brink, quite frankly, of extinction in the state, and they've rebounded. But now we need to fully understand what that impact is. And that's what a lot of our research has been looking at, is trying to tease out what kind of the predation rates are we seeing, how that is influencing or driving down a deer population or an elk population, and then also seeing if we can't develop a better overall method of estimating cougar populations on a unit-by-unit or an ecological unit basis. And we've actually got some ideas on how to go about doing that, and we're hopeful in this next budget cycle we might be able to do something like that. And once we can get there, then I think you will see us come back to our commission with recommendations for developing population estimates and management objectives for cougar, just like we do for most of our other species.
Thank you.
Moving on to sage grouse.
Oh, Representative Clem.
I don't know that I really want to get into this, but so you take it to your commission and you have a management objective that says, okay, they're impacting deer populations. Then what?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Clem, you're very familiar with the cougar issue and the ability of the department to utilize or not utilize all the tools that we'd want to or normally would use to manage cougar population. That's primarily the use of dogs. We do have hunting that's occurring now. They are taking cougars at higher numbers than what they did historically when we had very limited cougar seasons. But it is not, at this point in time, controlling the population in any way. And certainly, if we set population objectives and we're unable to meet those, it would provide a good discussion point for our commission with the public and with you on what tools you want to make available for managing cats.
Mr. Chair, but there's nothing that would prevent you from having ODF&W personnel hunt cougar with dogs, right? If
Co-chair,
that was the decision.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dembrough, that's correct. Measure 18 does allow the department to do it, and we are, in some cases, paying people to go out and remove cats versus, you know, the North American model of wildlife management is allowing hunting to do that and having somebody else pay us. And we're kind of flipping that around at this point in time.
This is going to get exciting here. Representative Gomberg has strong feelings, and we've never gotten to really hash this out. So how much does it cost when we either per animal or how much are we spending on doing cougar management by paid personnel versus...
I was going to ask the same thing.
Because we've got a big budget hole, so I'd like to know exactly how much we're spending.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representatives Clem and Gomberg, I don't have the exact figures off the top of my head. We could provide that to you. when we contract with Wildlife Services to do the work, it seems to me it works out somewhere around $3,000 to $5,000 a cougar. If we're utilizing volunteer agents that are operating under our authority, they're not as efficient because they're not out there full time, but the cost is lower. But that comes at, like I said, not meeting necessarily meeting our goals on cat removal as either as quickly or at all. So, you know, I would say this last or this biennium, we're spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $80,000 on our cougar target areas for removals. That's a ballpark figure, but we can get you the exact numbers if you'd like to have that.
I forgot how we set up the agent program. Is there a cap on the number of agents, or how many agents are we using compared to department personnel, or what's the limiting factor on agents?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Clem, the agent program is set up that there is no cap on the number of people that could be used. They have to meet all the same criteria that, in effect, a department employee would meet on being able to utilize firearms. So they have to pass fairly significant criminal background checks, et cetera. And then the number of agents that we have depends on each district and what they feel is their need to have a volunteer agent on hand and on call to utilize and help out with a bear or a cougar problem. In some cases where we've had a target area, we'll go out and put out the call and request for people to submit their names, then we'll run them through the system. They can't have any wildlife violations in their background or fishing violations. So, you know, right now we have about 30 people across the state that we have signed up.
They don't get to retain.
Last one at this point. The agents can, this is a part I'd forgotten, they can respond to damage type complaints on behalf of the department or safety kind of complaints. And if you've got a research program, then they could do general thinning of the population, let's say, but they're not able to just go out when there's no declared research area or no declared program and just work on target population.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Clem, that's correct. It's very controlled.
Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think Representative Clem and I probably have very little disagreement about the need to track, find, and dispatch dangerous animals, even with the use of dogs. My question for you is, if we're hiring these agents to do some of this work, how does that compare to situations where a police officer identifies and dispatches a cougar, as we saw in Bend last weekend? How does that factor into this bigger picture?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gomberg. Statutes give anybody the ability or the authority to kill a cougar that represents a human safety threat, is attacking their livestock. Just by law, they have the ability to do that. And certainly in circumstances like you saw in Bend, the police departments have the ability to make a call that this does represent a human safety threat, and that they want to remove that cat. They don't need permission from the department. That's granted under statute, and that's entirely their call.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Do you factor those numbers into your overall statistics?
Yes.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gomberg, yes, we do.
All right.
Every cougar that's killed in the state is factored into our numbers.
Thank you.
Please continue.
We'll move on to something less controversial. We've been working on sage grouse for a long time. We've really ramped up our efforts over the last 20 years, and it really is been in an effort to try and prevent a federal listing of sage grouse under the ESA. And sage grouse are sagebrush steppe obligate species found in southeastern Oregon, primarily a little bit up into central Oregon, a little bit up into the Baker County area. And there's a lot of things going on with them on their range. And we've been, like I said, undertaking a lot of research on sage grouse, in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and with Oregon State University and University of Nevada, Reno, and University of Idaho. And some of the things that we're looking at are the impacts of wildfire on sage grouse and also looking at impacts of predation on sage grouse. And we've also identified that there's some serious habitat threats to sage grouse, and a lot of that's tied to juniper encroachment, that as you get junipers move into sage grouse country, it opens up roosting areas for aerial predators, and it will increase nest predation. And you'll start seeing sage grouse quit using those areas. And also, as you end up with more juniper, you end up with less forbs and other beneficial types of food sources for sage grouse, and makes the habitat less usable. So we've been doing a lot of habitat type of work, again, in conjunction with the NRCS, the BLM, and we've been doing this research across a broad range of things. And because of the big concerns from a west-wide standpoint and the concerns over a listing, the western governors have all really focused on how do we collectively work to stop a listing, and is there anything that we can do? And virtually every state has undertaken their own effort. Ours here in Oregon, led by the governor's office, has been called SageCon, and it's really looking at a healthy sagebrush steppe habitat. It's looking at how can we maintain and provide for some economic activity within the sagebrush steppe, but at the same time conserve and protect sage grouse and their habitats so that we don't need a listing. The Fish and Wildlife Service identified two factors out of five in their warranted but precluding decision that they made several years ago. They need to make a final decision on whether to list or not in September of 2015. And those two factors they looked at were habitat fragmentation and a lack of regulatory certainty. And for us, that habitat fragmentation would mean something like wildfires that can wipe out a lot of habitat, or it would mean development activities that could impact really prime sage grouse habitat. And you know, that can tie back to county planning, that can tie back to fire suppression efforts. And the governor's budget contains two POPs within our GRB that provide funding to work on addressing some of these. It also provides funding for a suite of other agencies, DLCD, Oregon Department of Agriculture, and Department of Forestry to also work on these. And the goal is that when we walk out the other side, that we'll have addressed the listing concerns by the service and hopefully not have a listing within the state. Our wildlife areas that we have across the state really provide a whole suite of habitats for things, but they sometimes need help. And here's an example of our Summer Lake Wildlife Area that's down in south central Oregon. It's southeast of Bend, northwest of Lakeview. And it really is a wetland mecca within the desert. And it is to eastern Oregon that the Coquille Valley is to the coast. And it is the most significant wetland complex stopover point outside of the Malheur Refuge over out of Burns for migratory birds, primarily water birds, shore birds, and waterfowl in eastern Oregon and in the Pacific Flyway. It plays a significant role as a stopover point. And what we'd found through time was it was filling in with decadent vegetation. And through some federal grants, through our PR funds, and through a significant partnership with Ducks Unlimited, we've been able to go in and restore this wetland complex through a series of habitat restoration projects, water control projects, and now we've opened this thing up and really created those shallow wetland areas that the birds can use and made it more significantly more productive again. Wildfire, as already mentioned, is a concern on a broad suite of habitats, including our own wildlife areas, And we just highlight it real quickly that it's something that we were having to deal with. We had fires this last year on our White River area out of the Dalles and over on the Schneider area out of John Day. And we're looking at habitat restoration activities on both those areas that would include controlling invasive weeds and also doing timber salvage as we can to help with the restoration. Diseases are a concern from a wildlife standpoint, whether it's bird diseases or whether it's for mammals. And I don't know if you noticed this last winter, we had an avian influenza outbreak in the Pacific Flyway. It was first documented up in Washington with the loss of some birds, some wild birds, and then it moved into some domestics. It was documented here in Oregon. There actually was a depopulation of a small domestic flock of birds down out of Roseburg, and it's been documented in several other western states. More recently, it's been documented in a couple of different turkey farms back in Minnesota, so it's not something that's just confined to the Pacific Flyway. And I don't know if you remember back in the mid-2000s, avian influenza was a big concern primarily in Asia and Europe, and the potential for it to cross over into humans and cause an influenza outbreak. But more importantly, it does end up in domestic birds and domestic poultry. And these two turkey flocks that I just mentioned, in one case, they depopulated one turkey flock of 15,000 birds, and they've got another flock now of a little over 20,000 birds that they're in the process of determining what actions they need to take on that. So it can have significant impacts on domestic poultry operations and is a concern for us and Oregon Department of Agriculture. And then also locally, elk hoof rot disease was first noticed up in Washington, and it's a debilitating disease that can cripple animals. And you can see healthy feet of elk on the left and the right, the one in the center, what the bacterial infection actually does. There's no easy way to inoculate or to treat these animals. They're wild, free-ranging animals. We're part of a work group in Washington that's working on the issue. And, you know, we are looking to see if we can document it here in Oregon, and we are starting to document it in Clatsop County. We do have hotlines set up for people that can call in, and we do have also an internet-based reporting method. I talked earlier about our habitat section and the mule deer movements and ODOT. The picture on the left is of a crossing, the first of its kind wildlife crossing in Oregon that ODOT put in on Highway 97. They received national recognition from the Federal Transportation Association on this, and it provides a way for deer to move across 97 without impacting vehicles or the deer. And then we also, our habitat section provides technical assistance to ODOT and others on culvert replacements and ways to improve fish passage in a broad suite or locations and areas. We also provide a lot of technical assistance to Oregon Department of Energy, the counties, private contractors on energy development, whether it's wind energy, it's transmission line projects, excuse me, or it's something like the natural gas proposed development at Jordan Cove down in Coos County. And this is not only our headquarters technical staff, but also our field staff. And we've got the general fund increase that really recognizes that a lot of our bios, both fish and wildlife, are doing a lot of work that benefits the public at large. It has nothing to do with hunting and fishing. And that's why the general fund request that's in the GRB that would recognize that work and those efforts. Want to wrap things up real quickly with the conservation program and the things that we're doing there. This is one of our smallest programs. It is funded with lottery fund and federal fund primarily, a little bit with tax checkoff dollars. And the conservation program is primarily the implementation of the Oregon conservation strategy. 88% of the species in Oregon are not hunted and fished. and the conservation, our wildlife conservation program focuses on those species. And the conservation strategy really provides a method and a way to address the risks or the threats through voluntary actions to conserve those species into the future and maintain healthy, populations. We also have developed a significant mapping tool called Compass that people can go online and they can look at, hey, I'm in a certain spot and I want to know what fish and wildlife species are here. I want to know what the habitat's like. I want to know if there's things I can do to improve that habitat, or if I want to take actions on a piece of property, do some kind of a commercial development, is there anything I need to be concerned about that I need to plan for as we roll forward? This is going online and really will dovetail with the Western Governors Association chat tool that provides a cross-state boundary method of looking at the same thing. So really, it's a West-wide effort, but this focuses down on just Oregon. Also within the conservation strategy, we are working across a broad range of ways to do habitat restoration work. We're monitoring a whole suite of species from turtles to eagles, forest carnivores. The picture in the bottom right is of a montane red fox. It's a black version of it that was found in the North Cascades. This was the first time this had been documented in Oregon in a long time, and we thought that the last remnant populations of the montane red fox were actually down in the Southern Cascades from Diamond Lake South and in the northern Sierra Nevadas. So it's pretty exciting to document this in the North Cascades, and we're doing similar type work with Fisher and Martin, and looking at how what we might need to do from a management standpoint to ensure their long-term conservation. And we're doing a lot of work through our Willamette restoration program. It was something that was signed between Governor Kulongoski and Bonneville Power Administration. That's mitigation work for the Willamette Valley as a result of all the dams that were put into the Willamette system. And there's a whole suite of species that have benefited from that. Remnant oak woodlands here in the Willamette Valley, native grass prairies. I won't touch on the little fish. Ed's planning on doing that, but it was a significant achievement nationally. And really achieving a lot of things here. And then finally, want to wrap up with wolves. Wolves are primarily as a non-controversial species found in northeastern Oregon and spreading by popular request into the Cascades. And when we developed our first wolf management plan back in 2005, we were the first state in the United States that voluntarily developed a wolf management plan. And we wanted to do that before wolves actually showed up and were permanently here on the landscape. And we made some predictions within that plan on what the wolf population would do, where they first would pioneer in Oregon, how they would spread from there, and what would be the impacts from a population growth and from an impact on livestock. And so far, all the things that we predicted have happened. Wolves have shown up in northeast Oregon like we predicted. Wolves have had an impact on livestock. And it is something that we're having to manage. Most of the wolf locations, we have 15 known areas of wolf activity in the state. Most of them are located in northeast Oregon. We do have two that are in the Southern Cascades. You know, as a result of the depredations, we have the legislature a couple of sessions ago did establish a wolf compensation program in the Oregon Department of Agriculture that provides money for landowners that have documented wolf kills, documented by the department. They can get reimbursed for their losses. And then it also provides money for landowners that they can do proactive measures to try and prevent future depredations. And those funds are all dispersed through local county government committees. And just finally, kind of show you OR7 and the path of wolves moving out of northeast Oregon and how they've moved into the Cascades. It shows a couple of different things. One, that there are migration corridors or connectivity corridors that animals will use to move across the landscape. In this particular incident, you can see a little bit in northeast Oregon there, where right by the Interstate 84 sign, there's a lot of back and forth movement. You see some similar type things over just southeast of Bend. Wolves don't like to cross major highways. And we certainly, with some of our other GPS locations on wolves in Interstate 84, have seen them come up to 84, and they'll test it, and they'll move back and forth along it. Then they turn, and they go back, and they'll either disperse into Washington or disperse into Idaho, and in some cases disperse further south into Oregon. But that's certainly something that we're having to watch. We expect wolves to expand throughout the state, and we would say that so far our wolf plan is doing what we predicted it would do, and that wolves are successfully reestablishing themselves in Oregon and bringing conflict with that. And that concludes wildlife.
Thank you, Co-Chair. My question may be for either one of you, but Director Melcher and I had a conversation about the delisting of the wolves, and that was in the works. Is that still happening?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Heck, that is still in the works. We have a delisting process underway. It will begin at our April commission meeting later next month in Bend on, I believe, April 24th. So we'll have a first step of that delisting process will be a commission presentation and public comment, and then we will be coming back to the commission probably at our August meeting, but sometime later this year with the final recommendation and commission action as it relates to delisting.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Hensel.
Two quick questions. On the on the deer passage under 97, is that I know deer tend to have corridors. Is that actually, we're finding success with that?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, yes, we are. And we used, I showed that early map of the high conflict areas along Highway 97. And when you really zoom in on that, you can see the areas that deer want to cross. And that's what we used with ODOT in identifying where to put the crossing.
Because I've got a crossing place on Highway 11 north of Pendleton that would could use one of those too. The other thing is, since wolves are so non-controversial, I'm just wondering if Forest Park might be a possible location in the future.
I think so.
No answer. Okay.
You'll get there on your own.
Yeah, I advise you put the cute wolf puppies in your presentation, because I know later we're going to see the. Somebody will bring in the severed Labrador head laying next to an adult wolf, so you might want to preempt that with a couple wolf puppies. Just from my experience having done these presentations before.
Make a note of that.
All right, and so I think puppies. From a process standpoint, we have about, 40 more slides to go, I think, for tomorrow, as well as the DAS presentation, as well as Richard Whitman from the governor's office. So we could try and get through a few slides right now, if you don't mind, and then tomorrow we'll probably have to be a little bit, I apologize, probably a little bit quicker.
I was promised a fish story a minute ago. So.
You were a small, little yeah. cute fish?
Yeah.
little yeah, guppies up there.
I feel like there's a fish story coming.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name's Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator. And we will have, for Representative Clem, one small little fish picture for him. So I'm here to walk you through the fish side of the agency. And wanted to start by just help you understand kind of what our primary mandate is and how we go about moving forward with our management. We do manage your fisheries really from the international arena all the way down to your creek and pond in your backyard. And so it's quite a comprehensive venture. We are the stewards of the state's fish resources, and we take that very seriously. And throughout the presentation, I'll really be accentuating kind of the role we play on establishing a conservation platform upon which we do our management, and that is extremely important to us, knowing what the needs of the fish are, what's ailing them, and how to keep them strong and sustainable into the future so that they provide not just the economic benefits, but also the ecological benefits to the state. Now, part of that, taking care of our native wild fish resources, we also provide tremendous opportunities, economic as well as cultural and societal. A lot of that is supported through our hatchery programs, and so we have a very robust hatchery program. I'll get into some of the details on that. We also have very complicated fisheries because we're not the only sheriff in town relative to the regulation of those fisheries. And so we co-manage these not only with our tribal partners, but also with our other state and federal partners. Many of these fish that are important to Oregon travel across boundaries. So another very important part of this conservation platform is taking care of the habitat needs of these fish. And so we are primarily non-regulatory on that front, but that does not mean we don't advise on habitat issues as well as take actions relative to improving and restoring habitats. So just briefly on our structure, Fish Division is the largest component of the agency. We represent over half the budget and over two-thirds of the staff within the agency. And we have two primary sections, an inland fishery section and then a Columbia River ocean salmon marine section. And we have nine programs where we distribute the policy direction as well as the funds for the agency on the fish side. And I'll just touch on these briefly. Native fish conservation, the recreational fisheries piece, water and energy coordination. We have an engineering branch because we have the majority of the agency's infrastructure within our hatcheries. Screens and passage, I'll touch on that a little bit later. Hatchery management. Now, these are all on the inland side, and I should let you know the inland piece is really every aspect of the fish side except the ocean and the Columbia River. Kind of think of it that way. And then the other section, it looks like a smaller section, only having two programs within it, which is that marine and Columbia River. But this is really where the fish management really takes place on a daily basis. This is where we do most of our regulation, establishing fisheries not only in the Columbia River but in the marine, sport and commercial. So most of that takes place day to day on that that side of the Fish Division. So I will touch first on that inland fishery section. We'll see how far we can get through this chair rate field. So as I mentioned, this conservation plan approach to establishing that foundation of what the needs of the fish are, what's ailing them, and how to go about managing that in a sustainable way is very important and foundational to what we do. And then on that, we're always striving to how to make fishing better and more accessible. I'll touch on that a little bit later. We also are players within the water and hydroelectric issues throughout the state, and as well as energy development. So first starting, one of our programs within the inland fisheries is the Conservation Recovery Program. And once again, establishing this platform of stewardship and conservation has been something we take very seriously. Over the past decade, we have really focused on developing these foundations for each of these groupings of fish populations or these species. And so we've wrapped up basically 22 of the 28 different groupings of sea run type fish, the salmon and steelhead, and now we're moving into focusing on implementation of those plans. Obviously, a plan can be great, but if the fish don't see it implemented on the ground, it's meaningless, and that's where we're really focusing at this point. And one of those areas that I just wanted to give you a real shout out for is the coastal coho. It was one of our first Conservation plans, coastal coho are federally listed under the Endangered Species Act. And we have strived throughout the past decade and a half to get these delisted or not listed, have a no list or a delist, and been tied up in the courts on this several times. But we are very interested in moving forward with a federal recovery plan towards a delist. And part of the reason I accentuate this is really a tribute to Oregon and its volunteer efforts on habitat stewardship, as well as our agency looking seriously at hatchery reform as well as harvest reform relative to these listed coho. And it's really a success story. And we really would like to have that considered by the federal government again on considering a delist, and reflects the habitat stewardship that's taken place throughout the coast that's really helped these fish thrive. A lot more to do, but we're definitely on the right track, and we believe that it warrants this consideration. That'll be one of the things we work on in the coming years.
Why don't we go ahead and stop there, because the next slide is actually those baby fish.
That's right.
That for come tomorrow. Give them something to look forward to. So, and with that, it's 10 o'clock. We'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting today. We'll see you all tomorrow morning.
Thanks.